ride. Good morning, everybody. Good morning, all you magnificent melon heads of the world, and happy Monday, everybody. Today is November 3rd, 2025. Our top story this morning, well, it was hard to pick a top story this morning because there's a ton of stuff going on, including a lot of stories that just hit the tape like seconds ago, which is why I'm a little late starting the stream this morning. Guys, I apologize for that. I'll try to get you some of that time back. First thing, the big one going on this morning, or I should say it could be very big. Maybe it's not that big. All right, so I'm going to tread lightly on this subject. SOFR, the Secured Overnight Financing Rate, it spiked by 18 basis points last night. All right, you're probably sitting there saying, the what? It did what? SOFR is the rate that banks charge to lend back and forth between each other overnight. Large amounts, large short-term loans, right? The secured overnight, like one day financing rate. Now, SOFR a few years ago replaced LIBOR, the London Interbank Overnight Rate, as the prevailing interest rate that's used by banks to make these big loans overnight. Now, this is important because any major financial event that we've seen, like the dot-coms, like the GFC, like the problems we saw during COVID, typically, and I should say repo madness in September of 2019 is a big one, is typically preceded by some type of a big spike in the overnight lending rate. And we saw something like that. It wasn't as bad. Like the spike that we got during repo madness in 2019 was like almost 10%. It was huge. This is 18 basis points, 0.18%, but it's significant. Now let me just temper the enthusiasm for this story. There's probably going to be a lot of people who are out there trying to Chicken Little the hell out of this thing. It happened on Halloween, end of the month. When you see a spike in interest rates at the end of the month, it's not such a crazy occurrence. Now, this was a big one, and it's happening at a time when there are other signs of funding stress building in the banking system elsewhere. And so, again, not really sure what to make of this one. It could just be a normal spike at the end of the month. I fully expect this to come back down. How much? That's going to determine whether this is a big deal or not so much. But just to give you guys an idea, 2 days ago, which I guess that would be on, say, Wednesday, the SOFR was 4.27. Then we had the Federal Reserve cut by 25 basis points. When the Fed cuts the overnight rate, that brings SOFR down with it. So SOFR went from 4.27 to 4.04. Now you'll notice the Fed cut by 25 points, but SOFR only dropped by 23. That is that spread getting a little bit wider there. We're watching the short-term borrowings are going up even as the Fed is trying to push them down. So we went 4.27 to 4.04, and then a day later, we go right back up to 4.22, nearly wiping out the entirety of that Fed rate cut. That is very unusual. It's not unusual to see a little bit of a spike at the end of the month, but that's a big spike, and it's happening right after the Fed cuts. And there's some other things that are going on here. We have the reverse repo is nearly gone. We had Jerome Powell just told us that the Federal Reserve is going to stop their quantitative tightening. The timing of that is very curious. Powell has already indicated he's seeing some early signs of stress in money markets. Okay, that's interesting. We've also got things like the repo usage, not reverse repo, the standing overnight repurchase agreements. That has started to get used, which means banks need money just for a short term. They're going to the Fed to get it. We're also seeing the Fed's discount window usage tick up. And the discount window, that's where you go right before you die. All right. If you're borrowing money from the discount window, it's like you don't want people to see you borrowing money from the discount window, because if they see you doing that, they're going to pull their money out of your bank. So that is a sign of desperation. These numbers are all still small. All right. The use of the repo is still very small, especially compared to 2019. The discount window usage is very small, especially compared to where we were in March of 2023 when the banks failed. But all of these things are happening as the cockroaches scurry. Tricolor, First Brands, PrimaLend, First Help. What was that other one? Bankin Brombot and his boys over at Carryout Capital. All these private credit blowups that have been happening. Warnings from the IMF and the Bank of England about private credit. There are signs of stress in the financial plumbing, that should be should have people concerned. And guys, we're going to show some of these charts, but I got to leave it there. I'll be honest with you. I just don't know a lot about some of this stuff to be able to comment on it further. I do have my friend Joe Brown is coming on the channel tomorrow to talk about these early signs of liquidity. Now, we set this up a few days ago, this interview, before any of this happened. So I just need things to hold tight for like a few more hours. I don't want it to blow up before I bring Joe on the channel. How about right before I bring Joe on the channel? That would be a little bit easier. Anyway, we got that going tomorrow. Also in the news this morning, Kimberly Clark is buying Kenvue for $40 billion. That is was it 40 or 48 billion, I think was the actual number. A huge premium over Kenvue's closing price on Friday. Kenvue was spun off of Johnson & Johnson. That's the Tylenol maker. Their consumer products division, Kimberly Clark, makes tissues and paper towels, all kinds of things. Paying a big premium for Kenvue over its most recent closing price. That's interesting, but Kenvue has had one hell of a time since they were spun off from Johnson & Johnson last year. The stock was down big this year. Also going on this morning, what do we have? Oh, Berkshire Hathaway earnings. I couldn't read my own notes, sorry. Berkshire Hathaway. Big story with Berkshire earnings is insurance is doing very well, and Buffett and Co. are not buying anything. The cash pile is getting bigger. So one of the most successful investors of all time, I know he's retiring and he's kind of stepping away and all that, but one of the most successful investors in history is sitting on more cash than ever before, which means he is incredibly bearish about this market and he's not buying anything. We've got some stories about Nexperia today, some signs of relief. Maybe the Chinese are going to start shipping some chips soon after the Dutch government seized their headquarters. We've got another auto lender, another subprime auto lender is in trouble here. Now, this is a company that stopped lending months ago. I'm just finding out about this now thanks to my friend Lox Ganapathy at Unicus Research. Bayside Credit is the company that stopped making loans for subprime auto loans. I guess Bayside Credit CEO Zach Morris was unavailable for comment. Wink, wink. What else we got going on? Signs of a worsening job market this morning. Worries about the recent surge in layoffs. You know, we've had this no fire, no hire job market for a couple of years now. I guess it's turning into a fire, no hire job market. That might be a problem. But luckily, we're not looking because the government is shut down and we're not measuring anything in the job market here. So I guess we can all just keep humming along, whistling past the graveyard like nothing's wrong there. Scott Besson says SNAP benefits will come back as soon as Wednesday this week after a court ordered the government to start paying those out again. Shares of Beyond Meat are beyond ridiculous this morning. The company is delaying their financials and the stock is way down because of it. Something about an impairment charge. That's interesting. First Brands keeps getting worse. First Brands, that story a couple of days ago very quietly went from a $2 billion bankruptcy to a $12 billion bankruptcy. And I feel like that number got a whole hell of a lot bigger without anybody drawing any attention to it. So I got to point that one out. And we've got this flashy outfit, Onset Financial, apparently is one of their biggest creditors. And they used to make rap videos about how much money they were making, if only there were signs. We have got a whole bunch of stories about AI this morning. NVIDIA chips being sold to the UAE. Microsoft is cutting a big deal with some neo cloud company. Amazon and OpenAI are signing a big cloud deal this morning as well. All this is happening as off balance sheet debt is being used to fund the data center buildouts now. Special purpose vehicles and off balance sheet debt. And if you guys are getting Enron vibes here, that's only because that is exactly what Enron was doing right before they collapsed. But hey, again, you know, it's just a crazy conspiracy theory to think anything might be suspicious about this tens of trillions of dollars of bubble that has inflated around this product that sucks. I'm sorry, guys. AI does some neat things, but it sucks. You can't rely on anything it tells you. And if you have to spend all this time verifying everything it tells you, then is it really saving you any time? Maybe a little bit, but not $20 trillion of time, which is why 95% of companies are losing money on their AI pilots and abandoning them. Even as Sam Altman says a whole bunch of stupid shit about, oh, it's going to invent new physics just as soon as it figures out how to count all the R's in strawberries. Phase 2 physics. Good God. We got a lot to talk about this morning. Why don't we shrink my big melon of a head and let's see what's going on in the world of finance this morning. Hey, how about that like button and that subscribe button? All that good stuff for the algorithm really helps the channel grow. And you can come on back tomorrow, have your coffee with the Melonheads because we do this one every day. Right now, the S&P 500 is higher by 31 points, 0.46% to the upside ahead of the opening bell. We have got the Dow is just barely positive here, 0.07% to the upside, up by 34 points ahead of the open. And the NASDAQ is higher by 219 points. A lot of movement in the NASDAQ this morning. I think these AI deals are probably pushing this one higher, 0.85% higher for the NASDAQ in lieu of absolute catastrophe. Number go up. Meanwhile, the dollar keeps quietly getting stronger. And guys, this isn't the dollar getting stronger. This is the yen and the euro getting weaker, which I guess is essentially the same thing, potato, potato. But we're about to go to 100 on the Dixie again here, 99.96. That's up by another 16 basis points. The dollar is just the cleanest dirty shirt in the laundry here, guys. And so it keeps getting stronger. Don't mistake that for any confidence in the strength of our currency. It's just getting better because everybody else is getting worse. Against stuff, it still stinks to high heaven. Looking over at the bond market this morning, we've got yields are modestly higher, but not very much, especially considering what happened in SOFR last night. 30-year yield, 4.690. That's higher by 2 points and change. The 10-year's at 4.113. That's higher by 1 point and change. The 2-year's at 3.607, up just a fraction of a point. And the 1 month is actually down a chunk of a point here, 3.979 for the 1 month treasury. And looking over at commodities, we've got metals looking good this morning here, just a little bit higher. We've got spot gold, $4,015. That's up by $13 and change, or about a third of a percent. December gold futures, $4,026. That's higher by almost $30, or three quarters of a percent. Looking over at spot silver, $48.80. That's higher by about 12 cents, or a quarter of a percent this morning. Even as the December COMEX futures for silver is at $48.47. Higher by 33 cents or 0.67%. We're looking at about 30 cents of arbitrage between the two. So silver in London is still trading a little bit more expensive than silver in New York in December. So we're kind of in that kind of backwardation, kind of not backwardation. I know some people took issue with describing that as backwardation, but typically the futures price should be higher than the spot price. And that's not indicating there's still some signs of shortages in London for the silver market here, although a far cry from where we were just a few weeks ago. But I like the shiny. Copper, meanwhile, is higher by 0.41%. Palladium and platinum are both up by a percent and change this morning. And crude oil is up 0.1%, or about 6 cents higher, $61.04 for December WTI futures. Bitcoin is having a rough morning here, $107,828. As priced on Coinbase, that's off by about $2,000 from yesterday. It was quiet over the weekend. We were a little bit higher between Saturday and Sunday, but now a big step change down. All right, let's talk about SOFR, shall we? Now, guys, the SOFR charts are all pretty slow to update. So really the best I can do here is just show you the numbers and what we actually had. Let's scroll down a little bit here, get to those most recent numbers. Here we go. All right, what we're looking at here is these first three numbers. Actually, here, these numbers right here. This is what the overnight funding rate was. On the 29th, we were 4.27%. Then the Fed cut 25 basis points, but it only dropped by about 23 basis points. So the Fed cuts 25, SOFR only drops 23. That means the spread grew by 2 points. That was another indicator that things were a little bit tight, that there was a little bit more demand for money than there was supply of money. That's what that's indicating. Interest rates, basically the price of money, when you see that going up, that means supply and demand are out of balance. Now, it only stayed there for a day after the Fed cuts, because now here we go on December 31st, 4.22%, an 18 basis point spike. Now, again, I have to point out the end of the month there, all right? So that if we saw this in the middle of the month, it would be a hell of a lot worse than seeing this on Halloween, all right? End of the month, interest rate spikes, that's not unheard of. But 18 basis points of a move, that's a pretty substantial move in a rate that's not supposed to move more than a couple of points at any given time. We've been seeing the spread, the SOFR versus the Fed funds rate, or SOFR versus IORB, the interest on overnight reserve balances. We've been seeing that get wider and wider, and it just made a big move wider and on this last data point. Now, I expect this to come down. This should come down tomorrow, and I'll report it if it does come down tomorrow. The question is by how much. Are we going to go back to 4.04, or are we going to settle higher than that? That's going to be important. Now, the briefing block put out a pretty good post on this one. I wanted to share this with you. Today's SOFR popped to 4.22%. Looks like funding stress, not policy. Coming as banks have been tapping the Fed's standing repo facility, and the Fed just moved to NQT on December 1st to ease shrinking reserves and money market strains. So this is a pretty good post here because it touches a couple of things, right? The standing repo facility is getting used. The Fed just ended QT. We've got shrinking reserves. Jerome Powell mentioned some money market strains. Wait, what? What was that all about? And so seeing this spike in the overnight rate, not a four-alarm fire by any measure. It's just one more thing that's starting to happen along with other things starting to happen, which we're going to look at here, like overnight reverse repurchase agreements being nearly zero. Now, I just want to point out, let's set this to a one-year chart. This is reverse repo. Reverse repo spiked to $51.8 billion on Friday, right as this spike in SOFR happened. So again, end of the month, a spike, it's not unheard of. I expect reverse repo to come back. Now, reverse repo is indicative of extra cash in the system being parked at the Fed in exchange for borrowing short-term collateral. So seeing reverse repo spike at the same time SOFR spikes, that's a little odd. Unfortunately, you got to ask somebody who's much more familiar with the inner plumbing of the financial system to explain that to you. And typically, those guys are really hard to understand. So I'm going to do my best to study this topic and bring you guys what I find and hopefully ask intelligent questions when I talk to Joe tomorrow. Another thing, this is the Fed's discount window usage, and we've been watching this creep up. Now, these are only weekly snapshots. We only get these on Wednesdays. But, you know, this one here, this primary credit, liquidity and credit facility loans from the Federal Reserve, the discount window, this is financial institutions, either banks, hedge funds, private equity funds, somebody needed money and they went to the worst place to get it or the last place you get it before you die, about $7.9 billion. Not a huge amount, right? Let's zoom out. All right, here's that increase that I was just showing you over here. And then here's this big spike that happened when Silicon Valley Bank failed. So again, temper the enthusiasm here. These are just very early signs. It's not a crisis yet. And the other thing that we're seeing an uptick in is repurchase. All right, that one hit $30 billion, just under $30 billion on Halloween. Again, end of the month, a spike. So let's not get too excited about that. But we have seen this go from no usage whatsoever to one little blip to, okay, we're using it every other day. Now we're using it every day. And now all of a sudden, it's a significant amount. Again, by itself, this is not a fire. This is not an alarm. But in the context of all these other things, it's interesting and it's worth keeping an eye on. And once again, we have to temper that enthusiasm. Let's zoom out to a 5-year chart here. Actually, we have to go to a 10-year chart to capture it. This was repo madness, all right? That big breakdown in the overnight market that happened in September of 2019 that, in my opinion, led to a lot of the financial shenanigans that we saw with the VID. There was actually signs something bad was coming before anybody started getting sick in September of 2019. And so here's this recent uptick here. You can tell, okay, yeah, we're using it for the first time in years, but nowhere near when the last time it was a crisis. Just that this is the early signs of it. All right. So we'll keep an eye on all of this. All right. Let's talk about what happened. This big merger here. Kimberly-Clark to buy Tylenol maker Kenvue for $40 billion. This is a big deal to buy a company that's not doing so well. Kimberly-Clark agreed to buy struggling Tylenol maker Kenvue in a deal worth $40 billion. Kenvue stockholders will get $3.50 per share in cash and 0.14625 Kimberly-Clark shares per Kenvue share, according to a statement on Monday, for a total consideration of $21.01 a share based on Kimberly-Clark's Friday closing price. That is a 46% premium to Kenvue's closing on Friday. A huge premium. The deal has an enterprise value of about $48.7 billion, the company said. Current Kimberly-Clark shareholders would own about 54% of the combined companies, with Kenvue shareholders getting the rest. Kimberly-Clark said the combination will allow it to surpass Unilever to become the second biggest seller of health and wellness products after Procter & Gamble. Kenvue's portfolio includes Neutrogena lotion, Listerine mouthwash, Benadryl allergy medicine, Band-Aid wound care products. The company has struggled since it was spun off from Johnson & Johnson. Activist investors have taken stakes in Kenvue after a string of disappointing financial results. And in July, the company removed its CEO, Thibaut Mongin. All right, Thibaut, you're out of here. Not to mention the whole, like, taking Tylenol during pregnancy thing that happened. I don't know. There's probably going to be a lot of regulatory scrutiny of this deal, so I wouldn't expect this to close anytime soon. But the stocks are already moving. Kenvue stock is higher by almost 18% ahead of the opening bell this morning. $16.95 for Kenvue shares, up $2.58. But let's put that in perspective, shall we? Year to date, Kenvue stock down 32.7%. This company has not had a good year. So even with the hefty premium that they're getting from Kimberly-Clark here, Kenvue would still be down for the year. And Kimberly-Clark shares are selling off a little bit on this news, down, selling off quite a bit, actually, down 14% at $102.52 for Kimberly-Clark. That's off by over $17. And that company was already down 8% this year. So you can add a big chunk to that one. Again, it's probably going to take a while for this deal to close, but that is significant news this morning. Berkshire Hathaway and the ever-growing pile of cash. Boy, what do you do with that $381 billion? How do I get your problems, Berkshire? Berkshire's operating earnings jumped 34%. Buffett buys back no stock and raises cash hoard to $381 billion. Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway reported a sharp rebound in operating profit on Saturday while its cash pile swelled to a new high with no buybacks. Their operating profit generated from the conglomerate's wholly owned businesses, including insurance and railroads, jumped 34% year over year to $13.5 billion in the third quarter. The gains were driven by a more than 200% surge in insurance underwriting income, which rose to $2.37 billion. Buffett once again refrained from repurchasing shares despite a significant pullback in the stock. The company said there were no share buybacks during the first 9 months of 2025. Without any buybacks, Berkshire's cash hoard swelled to a record $381.6 billion, surpassing the previous high of $347.7 billion in the first quarter of this year. Berkshire also didn't find other stocks attractive, net selling equities in the third quarter for a taxable gain of $10.4 billion. So Berkshire shares doing all right this morning, up 1.4%. This is Berkshire's Class A shares, $727,000 a share. It put me down for a few of those, mate, while you're at it. Buffett is buying nothing, including his own stock. He's sitting on cash. That is an incredibly bearish take on the economy. And, well, you don't hear a lot about that these days. All you hear is AI, AI, AI. Meanwhile, we got some I don't know what you'd call this, maybe a silver lining in the auto sector here. Auto giants rally as China says it will consider exemptions for Nexperia chip exports. Some movement this morning. Shares of Europe's biggest car makers rose Monday as fears over an industry shortage of semiconductors appeared to recede. China on Saturday said it would consider some exemptions for Nexperia chip exports. It had previously blocked Nexperia semiconductors from leaving the country after the Dutch government seized control of Nexperia, owned by the Chinese company Wingtech. While the Nexperia issue is not fully resolved, with ongoing negotiations between the Dutch and Chinese governments to determine a path forward for Nexperia, we believe the potential near-term production headwind has been remediated, although we await more details, said Dan Levy, senior autos analyst at Barclays, in a research note published on Monday. So some signs of life in autos. And, well, we got more bad news in auto. Shout out to my friend Lox Ganapathy from Unicus Research, who sent me this one. I don't know if this is another cockroach or is this just another sign of trouble in the auto lending space, but another subprime auto lender stops originating loans. California's Bayside Credit paused originations in July. Irvine, California-based auto finance company Bayside Credit is no longer originating auto loans. Representatives for the company confirmed to Auto Finance News today. The company, which largely targets subprime consumers, stopped originating auto loans in July due to economic conditions. Company employees confirmed to AFN. The rest of this one is paywalled. So look, this is an old story that we're just hearing about. It started in July. Tricolor didn't go bankrupt until September. First Brands a few weeks after that. Primal End a few weeks after that. First Help a few days after that. Now we've got this name here. No word about fraud or anything like that, just more problems in subprime. If you stop originating loans, then you're no longer collecting fees. Your pipeline is clogged. Something is up at this company. But that, unfortunately, is all the details we have right now. I will be pulling on this thread. And if I find anything interesting, you guys will be the first to know. Meanwhile, the job market continues to get worse here. A wave of U.S. layoffs flash early warning sign for the job market. The labor hoarding that kept U.S. employers clinging to workers in the past few years appears to be coming to an end. When Starbucks fired 900 corporate employees in September, economists hardly batted an eye. After all, the coffee chain had already done a February culling as part of the new management drive to get the Frappuccino maker back on track. In October, Target eliminated 1,800 roles to help the beleaguered retailer move faster. For each corporate cutback, there's a clear explanation. Amazon and their 14,000 corporate jobs cut blamed artificial intelligence. Paramount's 1,000 workers just completed a merger. Molson Coors' 400 jobs can't get carb-conscious consumers to drink enough beer. I'm doing my part. Separately, each announcement can be read as a one-off. Yet taken together, some economists worry that the recent spate of cuts is starting to look a little less like individual belt tightening and more like a warning sign. You've got a substantial number of well-established companies making pretty big head cuts, says Dan North, senior economist at Alliance Trade Americas. You might start to wonder if these aren't random. Oh, are we starting to think these are not isolated events, these layoffs, much like the private credit blowups? Oh, really? Are we finally admitting that? Wow. Just a few months behind Jack. Congratulations, everybody. A report from the outplacement firm Challenger Gray & Christmas showed almost 950,000 U.S. job cuts this year through September. That's the highest year-to-date total since 2020, and that was before the heavy October run of announcements. Excluding the first year of the COVID pandemic, U.S. job cuts in the first 9 months have already surpassed full-year layoffs for every year since 2009. So they're saying get rid of that massive COVID spike. And we have the worst job market since 2009. Oh, great. 2009 was a great year. No, it wasn't. When something is almost the worst since the Great Recession, North says, that's not a very encouraging number. Those in the government sector have been affected the most, with almost 300,000 job cuts announced this year by Challenger's count. But other industries, including tech and retail, have also taken a hit. Corporate layoffs announced earlier this year by Southwest Airlines marked the first large-scale layoffs in its history. All problems with layoffs, all starting the most layoffs since 2009 in an environment where nobody is hiring. And I want to send a shout out to Don Johnson and my friends over at MacroEdge who posted this chart here. Job postings, many of which are fake garbage, are just 1% higher than February of 2020 now. And of course, this is showing the number of job postings in the United States. Okay, yeah, we had multiple job postings work from home and it inflated this number. And they've been coming down pretty much the whole time the Fed has been doing quantitative tightening. And look, now here we are, just a little bit higher than we were in the immediate aftermath of the vid. And even this is not really a good indicator because, as Don Johnson is rightly pointing out, most of these postings are fake garbage. They're jobs that have been posted for years that they have no intention of filling, or they're duplicate job postings, or they're just BS jobs for driving for DoorDash or something like that. So shout out to Don Johnson and MacroEdge, who has done a fantastic job of tracking these layoffs. And they're seeing the same thing that Challenger, Gray, and Christmas are seeing, a rapidly deteriorating job market. Meanwhile, Secretary Bessent says SNAP food benefits could restart by Wednesday. Not going to spend too much time on this one. The court ordered them to do it. And so Bessent is saying, okay, we're going to look at how we can do this. We have some emergency funds set aside. We need to make sure we do this legally. Could be as soon as Wednesday we see food stamps come back. This company, I just love talking about this company. One-time meme stock Beyond Meat falls 8% after delaying financial results due to an impairment charge. What are we impairing here? The fact that nobody wants to eat this soy boy crap because it's the mystery meat? And honestly, if it was between this and starvation, I'd probably consider eating dirt first, but I digress. Shares of Beyond Meat fell on Monday after the company delayed its third quarter financial results. The plant-based meat maker will now report earnings after the market closes on November 11th. Beyond Meat is said it delayed its results because it needs more time to calculate a material non-cash impairment charge. Look, Beyond Meat stock, the subject of this ridiculous rally over the last couple of days. The Reddit traders got a hold of this one. They ran it up like 1,300% in a couple of days. It went as high, what do we got, about $7.70 was the high, and now we're back down around $1.44 already, down 12% this morning on the delayed financials. This is why we don't chase meme stocks, guys. If you're lucky enough to own one before the meme stock rally hits, congratulations. Once it starts, don't chase, because this is always how it ends, always, every time. Now we got to talk about First Brands here. This is pretty interesting. I got this one today in AI Invest, who, by the way, is bombarding me with freaking pop-ups. The fragile pillars of audit reliability, lessons from First Brands collapse, and the need for governance reform. Now, it's not the governance reform that I want to talk about here. It's this first couple of points here. The recent collapse of First Brands Group, a $12 billion debt-laden conglomerate, has exposed critical vulnerabilities in most auditing practices and corporate governance frameworks. And right away, I noticed this over the weekend when somebody posted a Financial Times article. When did First Brands become a $12 billion bankruptcy? This was a $2 billion bankruptcy. Where did this extra $10 billion of debt come from? And this is the problem when the press is always like, their first thing they always tell you is remain calm. Don't worry. Don't sell anything. Keep buying the services that our advertisers promote. It's an isolated event. It's a one-off. It's widely contained. And that's why it went from $2 billion to $12 billion in the subsequent weeks, right? Because it was largely contained and isolated, and that's why we've had five more of these. When did this quietly become a $12 billion blow-up? It was two, guys. And nobody said anything when it went from 2 to 12. I didn't hear about it. I'm just seeing it mentioned like an afterthought. And by the way, as BDO USA, the company's auditor, faces scrutiny for failing to detect a sophisticated financial fraud, investors and regulators are left grappling with a stark reality. Even trusted auditors can falter when confronted with opaque structures and AI-driven deception. Hey, that's BDO. That is the same auditor that signed off on Supermicro's books to keep them from getting delisted. Probably nothing to worry about there, though, right? Ah. And right along the lines of First Brands, we got this one from Junk Bond Investor, at Junk Bond Invest on Twitter. I freaking love this guy. I find this account is hilarious. And he also posts some really good nuggets. He's saying, you've got to read this. First Brands' biggest creditor is a Utah firm most of Wall Street had never heard of. Onset Financial claims $1.9 billion, the largest of any lender who's owed money by First Brands. So these guys are going to lose up to $2 billion in this deal. They started in 2017 with a cold call and a $25 million deal. That grew to $1.9 billion of inventory at 12% interest rates. They made rap videos about the leasing game. If only there were signs that these guys didn't know what they were doing. They built a 55,000 square foot campus with a golf simulator, executive penthouses, and private Zen gardens. We sell money. Simple as that was the motto at Utah-based Onset Financial. And it looks like they're going to lose up to $2 billion thanks to the First Brands collapse. Gotta love it. All right. Meanwhile, we have a whole slew of just ridiculous AI deals today, guys. And it's hard to keep track of them these days. All I can tell you is the fraud and the complexity reaches a fever pitch right before the burst. First things first, NVIDIA shares up 2% in pre-market as the U.S. approves sales of its chips to the UAE. One thing I would point out is approving sale of advanced semiconductors to the UAE means these things will make their way into China. Remember that Hyperscale Nexus story, that money laundering front for an international drug cartel that was trying to buy $1 billion worth of NVIDIA chips? Yeah, they were buying them for the Chinese. All right, so if these things are, they were based out of the UAE, the Hyperscale Nexus, they were in Dubai, shared an office with Daniel Kinahan, all that good stuff. That video to this day just boggles the mind that nobody cared about that story, but I digress. So NVIDIA stock up 2% on this news, trading at $208, now up 2.75%. Up another $5.50 this morning. We've got more AI stories, though. Microsoft signs a $9.7 billion AI cloud deal with Iren. Iren is another one of those neo clouds like Nebius, like CoreWeave. I'm seeing Microsoft do this a lot. They're no longer scrambling to build their own data centers. They're going full Liberty Mutual here. They only pay for what they need. They're renting from the neoclouds rather than spending the big CapEx up front to build them themselves. Now, this is Microsoft committing to spend $9.7 billion on this. Iron will then take that $9.7 billion deal and say, look, we've got commitments from Microsoft. Lend us the money so we can go buy these chips from NVIDIA to rent them from Microsoft. So ultimately, this is going to further inflate NVIDIA's earnings. But backing that debt, backing NVIDIA's earnings, is going to be an IOU from this neocloud company and a non-committal, or what do you call it, a non-binding letter of intent for Microsoft to use these data centers. If Microsoft decides they don't need them after a while, that debt goes bad. So that one has Iron stock ripping this morning, Microsoft doing pretty well. And then we had another one hit right before I went live. I apologize for starting so late today, guys. This story was the reason. OpenAI signs $38 billion compute deal with Amazon, partnering with a cloud leader for the first time. All right. I'm going to try not to scream this. I don't want to hurt anybody's ears. But let me just start off by saying, deep breaths in through the nose, out through the mouth. OpenAI doesn't have $38 billion. There. Oh, it feels great to just get that out in the open. Oh. A great load has been lifted. Sam Altman, OpenAI. You ain't got $38 billion, Lieutenant Dan. Yeah. Just got done over the weekend, this ridiculous soundbite of, you know, somebody, it was an investor in OpenAI, asked Sam Altman, says, hey, Sam, you did $13 billion in revenue last year. How are you going to meet these spending commitments for $1.4 trillion between now and 2030 when you only have $13 billion in revenue? And oh, by the way, you're still operating at a huge loss. Well, here's another $38 billion to throw on that $1.4 trillion pile of money Sam Altman doesn't have that he is promising to spend, that the people he's promising to spend it with are out there borrowing against to build products that don't make money. Oh, crap. This is going to be so bad, guys. And it's getting worse by the day. It's getting more comical by the day. OpenAI has signed a deal to buy $38 billion worth of capacity from Amazon Web Services. By the way, Amazon is one of the biggest owners of Anthropic. So I guess they're still going to be friends over there. I don't know. That's new. Its first contract with the leader in cloud infrastructure and the latest sign that the $500 billion AI startup is no longer reliant on Microsoft. Under the agreement announced on Monday, OpenAI will immediately begin running workloads on AWS infrastructure, tapping hundreds of thousands of NVIDIA's graphics processing units in the U.S. with plans to expand capacity in the coming years. But again, yeah, we're spending a whole bunch of money we don't have. Good news, everybody. I am going to buy $38 billion worth of Jell-O pudding pops. So you can all go out and buy stock in Jell-O because I've promised to spend that money. And if you're sitting there saying, but Jack doesn't have $38 billion, well, then congratulations. You're paying attention. And this is the really scary thing about this whole deal. This is what bugs me the most. Meta and XAI spread risks of AI splurge with off-balance sheet debt. Off-balance sheet debt. Just say that over and over to yourself. And then Google that. Or better yet, go on one of these silly chatbots and say, give me examples of off-balance sheet debt causing financial crises. And look at all the results you get. And of course, the first one you're going to get is going to be Enron. Because that's the famous one. Just this month, Meta Platforms has secured about $60 billion in capital to build data centers. Part of its spending to go ahead in the artificial intelligence race. Half of that won't show up on the social media giant's balance sheet as debt. Half of that money won't show up on their balance sheet as debt. So they're making their financials look better by parking that liability somewhere else. Meta is among firms popularizing a way for debt to sit completely off balance sheet, allowing enormous sums to be raised while limiting impact on its financial health, or limiting impact on its perceived financial health. Morgan Stanley structured a $30 billion deal, the largest private capital transaction on record, where the debt would sit in a special purpose vehicle tied to Blue Owl Capital. That made it easier for Meta to raise another $30 billion this week, the usual way, in the corporate bond market. Off-balance sheet debt through special purpose vehicles or joint venture tied to assets like chips or real estate is becoming the go-to for AI data center deals, bankers say. Morgan Stanley estimates that tech firms and others will need as much as $800 billion from private credit and deals tied to specific assets, including in SPV format, by 2028. And remember, guys, this $800 billion is going to be parked in your 401k, in your IRA, and in your pension. As big tech companies report earnings this season, some of their liabilities may be hidden in deals they're responsible for indirectly. Oh, hidden liabilities. What's the worst thing that could happen? The rapid buildup of debt tied to AI, about $100 billion a quarter, raises eyebrows for anyone that has seen credit cycles, said UBS strategist Matthew Misch in an interview, and the capital raises are accelerating. Off-balance sheet debt and separate financing vehicles have a notorious history linked to several high-profile scandals where the scale of debt surprised investors. In 2001, Enron's off-balance sheet entities triggered the energy company's collapse. Later that decade, banks had a common practice of moving mortgages and other kinds of debt into off-balance sheet vehicles before financing them, which ultimately resulted in crisis when the banks were forced to bring the liabilities back onto their balance sheets. Accounting and rating standards have changed since, but financial engineering is back in style, making some analysts wonder if all the commitments will be easy to spot. Hiding liabilities to finance the biggest tech bubble in history. This is some 2020s bingo shit right here, guys. Good God. Hey, I just want to say thank you very much to Jim Watari. Thank you, Jim, for gifting 20 Nobody Special Finance memberships. I appreciate that very much, Jim. Welcome to the Melon Patch, you 20 wonderful melons, you. Be sure and say thank you to Jim. Jim, I appreciate that very much. Just a reminder, guys, with the membership, you get a free super chat every month. So use that, and I will read and respond to your questions on the air. Nashville Pasta Man says SOFR spreads are also used for commercial real estate flex lending. That's interesting. So possibly these signs of funding stress. Look, is that the cause or the effect there, Pasta Man? I mean, what could be causing a buildup of stress in the overnight lending market? Commercial real estate's got to be on that list. That's a whole big crisis that is still going on out there. I mean, subprime auto is all the rage right now. And now telecom, thanks to Bonk and Brombot, now that the financial press is willing to cover that story a week after I broke it on my channel, by the way, exclusive Wall Street Journal. Yeah, SOFR spreads are also used in commercial real estate. So, you know, is that the cause or the effect? I don't know. Let me know in the comments. But, you know, either way, it's not going to help commercial real estate. I can tell you that. Thank you very much, Pasta Man, for supporting the channel. Nacho Man, thank you, sir. He says, Jack, what's your concern about buy-ins for the banks? Now, when you say buy-ins, I'm not sure what you're talking about here. Is this concern with the AI? With banks right now, I'd say the single biggest risk for small banks and for credit unions is what's going on with auto and subprime auto. And I think that would probably spread to the ABS market. If appetite for auto ABS goes away, then you're going to have a lot of small institutions stuck with a lot of high-risk auto debt on their books. So that's a concern with the banks there. Private credit exposure, the fact that First Brands quietly went from $2 billion to $12 billion, there's another $10 billion of money that's going to go up in smoke somewhere out there. I'm getting a message from Mish here. Okay. All right. You're talking about bail-ins. Thank you. Thank you, Mish. I appreciate that. Nacho Man says, what's my concern with bail-ins for banks? All right, bail-ins, I did a video about that a couple of weeks ago. I'll put a link to the video in the comments when we're done here. The problem with bail-ins is, you know, say you're over the FDIC limit, you get your $250,000 back. Anything over that, they give you stock in a now worthless bank instead of your money back. That's what a bail-in is. And that's supposed to be what happens. That's what we should have done with Silicon Valley Bank when they went belly up. Instead of the Federal Reserve and the FDIC basically riding to the rescue with the, what did they call it? The Bank Term Funding Program. Yeah, a fancy acronym for printing money to bail out a bank. What should have happened was people should have got $250,000 and stock in Silicon Valley Bank instead. But the government just decided, no, Silicon Valley Bank is a systemic risk to the economy. So all the things we changed after the GFC, we're going to throw that all out and we're going to do too big to fail again. So the concern with bail-ins is that you lose your money and you get stuck in a worthless bank. And, well, that sucks. That's what's supposed to happen. But does that suck more than printing money and parking that risk on the taxpayers or the Federal Reserve's balance sheet and socializing the losses? Does that suck less or more than that? It's up to you guys in the comments. Thank you very much, Nacho Man, for supporting the channel. Austin Feinberg, thank you, sir, for supporting the channel. He says, show you did with Lox was great. Should do more frequent collabs with other creators in relevant sectors of the economy like Real Estate Mindset, Melody, Orlando Miner. People need exposure to the larger macro picture. Yeah, I can tell you, I really love having Travis and Melody on the channel for just that reason, because Travis and Melody, they're zeroed in on housing. That's their bread and butter, and that's a blind spot for me. I cover bonds. I cover subprime auto and whatever flavor of the day, you know, metals and everything. But housing market is one area that just I only have so much attention during the day. And because Melody and Travis lived in that, and I'm familiar with Orlando Miner. I've never had him on the channel, but I have seen his channel. He's another guy who does a really good job in real estate. So I do plan on doing more collaborations in the future, starting tomorrow with Mr. Joe Brown. Thank you, Austin, for the kind words and for the encouragement. I appreciate that very much. And the generosity. Hey, Tom Dillon, thank you, sir. He says, hell's bells, national debt went up $1 trillion in 78 days. Quite a record, even for this outfit. I'm buying more gold this week. The fiat Titanic is taking on water. Scrooge McDuck for next Fed chair. Let's go swimming with Scrooge McDuck. Sign me up. Look, I don't have any gold here, but I did buy some shiny recently, and I like to keep my America flag bar right here. This is how you get away from this BS. This is how you exit the casino. Now, I would just add, guys, this is not a get-rich-quick scheme. This is, I wouldn't even say an investment, although some people would probably disagree with that. I see this as a savings vehicle. This is a way to preserve your wealth without taking risk. All right. Now, there are risks associated with physical metals that you need to educate yourself on and protect yourself against. But it's a way to just say, I'm not playing in this stupid casino. I can see what you're doing with your special purpose vehicles and your off balance sheet debt. And then over in private credit, your continuation vehicles and your CD squares and your secondaries and now tertiaries, gag me. All the things they're doing to avoid finding out what these investments are actually worth because they know they're not worth shit. Yeah, I'll take my shiny too. Thank you very much, Tom. I appreciate the super chat, sir. Lear C. You know him says, is there a job chick interview on the horizon? You want it? You get it, Lear C. I'm gonna bring Amanda. Well, I'm gonna invite Amanda on the channel. Why not? I think it is long overdue. I have really enjoyed Amanda Goodall's work on Twitter over these last few months. In particular, she has really led the charge on H-1B visas, and I think she's one of the reasons, if not the reason, that the government has cracked down on H-1B visa abuse is thanks to the light that she has shined on that. So that is a good idea. Maybe we'll reach out to Amanda and bring her on the channel. That is not a bad idea. Thank you, Lirshi. Appreciate the super chat. Brojo's 420 Cafe says, crypto changes the equation for crash predictions. Okay. Crypto, does this change the equation for crash predictions? No, it doesn't. Let me just tell you this right now, guys. Crypto overlaps a lot with the AI bubble right now. And one goes, both go. If the AI bubble were to burst, it's going to take crypto down, and that'll be what causes the new crypto winner. If crypto goes down, it could take the AI bubble down with it. Why do I say that? Because the Bitcoin miners are now the data center operators. The Bitcoin miners decided they're going to cash in on this data center thing. They've started taking on debt to build high-performance compute and build more data centers to go along with their Bitcoin mines. If that debt starts to go bad, or if the market stops spending on AI, well, then all that debt won't be able to service, and the Bitcoin miners will be forced to either go bankrupt or sell their Bitcoin holdings to service that debt. That could create a waterfall of selling. That's how problems in AI could be problems in crypto. Problems in crypto could be problems in AI. If the crypto bubble bursts, if we get another FTX, if some outfit out there goes belly up, or if Saylor goes burst and he gets margin called at Strategy, all right, now all of a sudden the crypto firms can no longer afford to borrow more money. Nobody will lend to them. They no longer have the cash available to them to build out their data centers, which is going to, by effect, hurt NVIDIA's sales, hurt the build-outs for the hyperscalers. So crypto burst could actually trigger the AI bubble to burst. Now, the two are attached at the hip, and if one goes down, they're both going to go down. So does any of what we talked about today change my prediction that crypto winter is here? No. No, it does not. I'm right where I was. Thank you very much, Brojo, sir, for supporting the channel. Pasta Man's back again, says, believe me, without strippers, I'm not driving a 7 Series. Oh, okay, we're quoting The Big Short again. Yep, RCI is collapsing down 60% year over year. Hospitality is swimming naked. RCI, is that Royal Caribbean? Is that what that one is? Let me verify that and make sure I got the right name here. I'm pretty sure that's Royal Caribbean. And you said hospitality, so I'm guessing you're right. Let's see. No, RCI, Rogers Communications, RCI Hospitality Holdings. So it's not Royal Caribbean. Okay, this must be like a hotel REIT is probably what that is. That's interesting. So down 60% year over year, hospitality swimming naked. Well, we had a decline in international tourism in the U.S. We've seen from the budget air carriers that they're not doing well. We know business travel is slowing down. So really, you've got the 10% of consumers that are doing really well. Is that enough to keep the hospitality industry afloat? No, no, it is not, Pasta Man. And Mish is saying RCI owns strip clubs. Oh, is that the outfit? You know, I saw a story about them in New York. What the heck happened? I can't remember. Now it's coming back to me, but I can't put my finger on it. There was a story about this outfit recently. Son of a gun. Pasta Man, my memory's drawing a blank right now. Thank you, Mish, by the way, for the text message. He's plugging me, giving me ideas here by text while we're talking here. So, yeah, we're tapping into the strippers from the Big Short. We've got commercial real estate. We've got hospitality. And, of course, hotels and strip clubs. Yikes. Yikes, Pasta Man. Yeah, pay attention to commercial real estate, guys. That's another one that's still out there, and the market still has not taken the losses. And I don't know, loans backing strip clubs, is that a thing? Anything affecting strip clubs, man. Big cash business overlapping with organized crime. Yikes. Very yikes. Thanks again, Pasta Man. Gordon Guanu says, maybe the lesson we should have taken from Enron wasn't to accommodate, legalize, and subsidize fraud. I'm just saying. Wow. That is just a radical, radical opinion there, Gordon Guano. What do we need one of these? What? Let frauds fail? Huh? 404 error. Does not compute. Syntax error. Yeah. Let frauds fail, and then maybe we'll have fewer frauds. What a freaking concept. Now, look, Enron, to my knowledge, I don't think Enron got bailed out. But Enron was one of the things that made the dot-com bubble burst so much worse. And then the Federal Reserve lowered interest rates in order to accommodate the dot-com bubble. And then lowering interest rates in order to ease the burden from the dot-com bubble bursting is what created the bubble in housing and the CDO problems and the mortgage-backed securities, which is what led to the GFC. And then the lower interest rates after the GFC that the Federal Reserve put in place to try to ease the burden of that led to the blowout in private equity, rinse, repeat through COVID. And now here we are with the cockroaches scurrying. It's almost like all this endless easing to accommodate one crisis just plants the seeds of the next crisis every time. Maybe we just let the crisis run its course and carve out the rot. What a radical idea, Gordon Guanu. I like the cut of your jib, sir. Chris Bott says, interview your dad on the channel. Dad? Oh, man, I don't know. We get our first Blurton's Motorcycle, Bicycle, Tricycle Shop reference on the channel if we interview dad. I don't know, Dad. What do you think? You want to come on the channel? Oh, Dad, he's got some pretty crazy stories going through real estate in the 1980s and things they had to do to get mortgages done back then. And the kind of interest rates and the numbers they were talking about just blow my mind when I hear it. Interesting. First demand for Dad on the channel. All right. I don't know. Two such ruggedly handsome faces in one place might just tear a hole in the fabric of the universe. I don't know. Thanks, Chris, for supporting the channel. Crusty White Bread says, thanks, Drac. Great show as always. And thank you, Crusty White Bread, you toasty SOBU. Thank you for being a Melonhead member for 14 months. Appreciate the good vibes and the support of the channel. M&J, what's going on, M&J? Pasta says, Rick's Hospitality. Yes, that's RCI. Thank you, M&J and Mish, by the way, for trying to help me limp along through that answer. I swear there was something about Rick's Hospitality, and it's just I can't tap into it. It's being blocked by like lines from 80s TV shows and cartoons I watched as a kid right now, but it's in the warehouse somewhere. I'll find it. Thank you, M&J. Break my wallet, Motorsports. I love that. Rick's Cabaret. There he is again. New York tax fraud. The tax fraud. That was the one. Okay, they were bribing. Now I remember. You guys are awesome. Breaking. We've had a breakthrough. Rick's Cabaret. They were involved with bribing the auditors from the tax division in New York, and including bribing them with lap dances. And what was it? I think it was like lap dance credits. You know, if we're using the AI bubble as a reference here, yes, now I remember Rick's Cabaret. Okay. And then Pasta Man said they were down 60% year over year. Yeah, that's not so good. That's not so good. Wow. Thank you guys for helping me tap into my memory there. I remember. I read so many stories and consume so much news on any given day that I lose these things. Let's see if I can. Sometimes if I just type in the name, it comes up and I don't have to search for the article. If I can do that real quick, we'll do it as midnight comes in here to start attacking. Here it is. There's the story. It came right up. I knew it. All right. We're going to, since you guys are obviously into this story and so many of you have gone to such great lengths to refresh my memory, Al Midnight Al, let's talk a little bit about Rick's Cabaret here. Rick's Cabaret parent and executives indicted in New York tax fraud and bribery case, September 16th. All right. It's been a while, but now it's coming back to me. Let's see. The parent company of Rick's Cabaret and other strip clubs, as well as five executives, have been indicted over their alleged roles of a 13-year bribery scheme to avoid paying millions of dollars in New York sales taxes, says Attorney General Letitia James, who herself is being indicted for fraud, I might add. Oh, this story is just great. RCI Hospitality Holdings officials include CEO Eric Langan and three of the company's Manhattan clubs together face nearly 80 charges in a New York state court, including criminal tax fraud, bribery, and conspiracy. Let's see. The defendants deny the allegations. Okay, the shares tumbled. Let's see. How did they do it, though? The auditor, whose name is redacted from the indictment, allegedly received at least 13 complimentary trips to RCI-owned strip clubs in the Miami area, including up to several thousand dollars per day of private dances. Are they round-tripping revenue by bribing their tax auditors? Manhattan clubs charged in the indictment include Rick's Cabaret, Vivid Cabaret, Hoops Cabaret, and Sports Bar. One defendant, RCI controller Timothy Winata, allegedly delivered the bribes. The indictment included dozens of emails and text messages allegedly related to the scheme. Wow, how did I forget that one? How did that one slip from the memory? That's a pretty wild story for that one to slip from the memory. But guys, the news cycle for the last month or so has been pretty busy. So thank you guys for refreshing my memory there with that one at the end. M&J, Mish, Break My Wallet Motorsports, and of course, Pasta Man who gave me that one. What a world, man. What a world we live in. All right, guys, we've been running pretty long this morning and we started late. I want to thank you guys so much for all the generosity in the super chats this morning. Thank you guys. Don't forget that like button and that subscribe button, all that good stuff for the YouTube algorithm. Thank you also to my magnanimous melonheads on Patreon and YouTube. Thank you guys for supporting the channel. Links are down in the descriptions to those things. Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad. Love you guys. Everybody, till next time, live small and dream big.